Welcome to Church 180. My name is Tony, and I'm excited to be speaking again today to you guys. I have to be honest. I was saying this to our team at 9:30 that was in. I was saying this series, I love it so much, but it is so difficult to cover 1st and 2nd Samuel in 13 weeks. This is the longest series we've ever done, but this is like, and today, like, you know, I was like kind of looking ahead and I had planned out the series, but then, you know, you go back to your plans and you're like, well, what about this? Well, what about this? Well, what, you know, and today, I gotta be honest, today is one of these times that honestly, today should be two messages. I'm gonna try to bring this together into one because I think they say, you know, these two, we're gonna be in 2 Samuel chapter 6 and 7 today. And I wish we could take a week for each of these chapters because there's so much rich content there. But I'm gonna try to do my best to bring them together to you this morning. But I really do think, after all the sermon was written, after all the message was done and all my notes were taken, I was looking over it this morning and I was kind of thinking everything could kind of be summed up in this one statement, okay? And I want to just let this fall on you before we get going. And the statement is this, is I really do believe that what we see from these stories that are happening, ancient texts, all the way up to the writings of Jesus and the church today, it's saying it's really, 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 really easy to be religious without following Jesus. I think that's what it's saying. It's really, really, really easy to play the religiosity game and to show up at church and to take the sacraments and to do the thing and have the traditions and whatever and all this stuff. But to actually do all of that and not follow this first century Jewish rabbi that we've been called to follow, the living God who was a human being in flesh who said, do as I've done, become like me. And we just, you know, and I just have to feel as I get going this week that there's some of us in here today that don't want to play church, but we want to be the church, right? In the world that we live in. See, I was thinking about some of this stuff and the passage that we're going to look at today. It's super obscure, but it was reminding me of how it's stupid that I don't read the Chronicles of Narnia with my kids, right? Anybody read the Chronicles of Narnia in here? You know what I'm talking about, right? Like, I meant to, like, open it up this week and, like, start to read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with my kids and everything. And then, of course, we got busy and didn't get around to it and everything. But I was looking at this passage, and it was reminding me of this exchange that happens in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Chronicles of Narnia, if you're familiar with it. So you have this lion who is like a Jesus-type figure in the story. It's like this magic fairy tale written by C.S. Lewis, incredible narrative, incredible story. And this lion, his name is Aslan, and it represents Jesus. And these kids are talking about this lion, and there's this exchange. I think it's going to be on the screen, and it's Susan who says it, the character. She says, Aslan is a lion? The lion, the great lion? Ooh, said Susan, I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. So it's a talking animal, I know. Safe, said Mr. Beaver. Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. And we're going to get to this passage today where I'm not going to be able to make a lot of sense out of it for you guys. I'm going to try, but I'm not going to be able to make a lot of sense out of it because God shows up and does something that does not sit well with our 21st century perspective of the world. It doesn't. I mean, this is the passage where God smites a guy. You know, he's a little bit disobedient to something we would think is not that big of a deal. It's just some traditions that God has at the time. And as soon as he does what he does, burp, he falls over dead. But I think there's so much to teach us that it's there. But before we get going, I want to recap a little bit for you guys. Here we are. We don't have time to recap much. You can go back and listen. But Saul, who's the first king of the ancient nation of Israel, he was disobedient. The kingdom was divided and taken from him. David was anointed the king. He ended up killing Goliath. He was appointed by Saul, and David was appointed by Saul, became successful. Saul was jealous. Saul tried to kill David. David was on the run for 25 years. Saul finally dies at the hands of the Philistines. And last week, we finally got to David becoming the king. And the scene that we're going to look at today is David, this moment where he finally becomes the king, and he wants to turn the nation's hearts back to the living God. He wants to turn the people's hearts back to God. And so there's this thing called the Ark of the Covenant. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Ark of the Covenant. We're going to talk about that today. If you were a millennial in here and you grew up watching Indiana Jones, you may know what the Ark is, right? If you're not, you're probably like, Tony, you're old, you know, and whatever. I digress. But the Ark, okay, it represented the presence of God. I think we have, it was representative of the presence of God amongst his people. And the Ark had not been mentioned for a long time, okay? Because the Ark, it was mentioned in 1 Samuel chapter 7, okay? We're now in 2 Samuel chapter 6. So it's been several years since the Ark had been mentioned. And before that, the Ark had actually resided, the presence of God, the believed presence of God had resided in the land of the Philistines as kind of a war trophy for whenever they defeated the Israel army. Okay, so it's been there, and now in 1 Samuel chapter 7, it comes back into the nation, and it sits in the house of a guy named Abinadab, okay? And it's been sitting there for a long time. The Ark has been sitting there for a long time. And David, okay, as he becomes the king, he wants to usher in this great celebration, and he wants to have this Ark brought back to the city of Jerusalem. Okay, he wants to have it brought back. And so he throws a party to get this Ark back. And I know, I feel like there's so much I need to explain, because the Ark, let me just go to my notes real quick to say all the stuff that's there. The Ark is, it's this box that's 3 feet, 9 inches long, 2 feet, 3 inches wide, and 2 feet, 3 inches high. God had commanded Moses 400 years prior to this text to make this Ark, and he had commanded Moses to put three things in particular in it. So the three things that were in this box was, it was the tablets from the Ten Commandments that were given to Moses on top of Mount Sinai. So you got these tablets with the Ten Commandments. You have a jar of manna. Okay, and the manna is the food that was provided to the Israelites as they were wandering through the wilderness for years. So they have this jar of manna, they have the tablets, and then they have the rod of Aaron, whenever he threw it down and it became like this plant, it budded into this plant. And I believe it was kind of like, by reading the scholars this week, I believe the tablets showed God's rulership. The jar of manna from their time in the wilderness showed God's providence. And Aaron's staff that miraculously budded showed God's guidance. So the Ark was showing the rulership, the providence, and the guidance of God. And it represented the presence of God amongst his people. And so David becomes the king, and he basically throws this huge worship service to usher the Ark into the city of Jerusalem. And they're going nuts. And much like I want Church 180 to come alive in the Holy Spirit, right? Like, I love whenever, you know, I get a front show seat to your guys' hearts awakening to the things of God in the life of Jesus. That's why I do this. There's nothing I love more than to see that. And I have to believe in this moment, that's the heart of David. He's like, we need the presence of God to be ushered through here in my kingdom. We need your hearts, the people's hearts, to turn to the living God, to make him their priority and to feel his presence and experience his presence and his rulership, his providence, and his guidance here in our kingdom. We need to see that. And so they're throwing this big party and they're walking the Ark up in to the city. And so we'll get to this text. Here's what it says. It says this: David again, chapter 6, verse 1, David again brought together all the able young men of Israel, 30,000. He and all his men went to Bala in Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim on the Ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart, okay? Circle, highlight, like literally, new cart. This is going to come back into play. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart, with the Ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it, and David and all of Israel were celebrating with all of their might before the Lord with castanets, harps, lyres, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. Okay? So get the scene. It's been in the land of the Philistines for a long time. Then it's been at the house of Abinadab. And then they put it on a new cart, and they start to wheel it before the people. This new cart, they're wheeling it before the people. I assume wheeling it. It's a cart, right? And so it's coming through, and they are worshiping their brains out. This is equivalent to every hand in the air, right? This is the worship song, the eyes closed, the moment before God, the whole thing, like ushering in on a new cart. Now, God had given very specific instructions as to how to transport the ark. He'd given very specific instructions. Like we see in Exodus, what chapter? Exodus chapter 25 and Numbers chapter 4. In Exodus chapter 25, we learn that the ark is meant to be carried shoulder high on poles. That's the instructions God had given. Exodus 25. Numbers chapter 4 said not just any Levite from the tribe of Levi, but Levites from the family of Korah were the only ones eligible to transport this ark. So God had given them very specific instructions, and here they are. David's trying to turn their hearts back to God. He's trying to get the nation to worship God, and they forget to transport the ark the right way. I don't know if they forgot. I don't know if they were negligent. I don't know what happened. They just weren't following Exodus 25 and Numbers chapter 4 as they're transporting this ark. And so they have this new technology, and they have this new way of transporting the ark. The first point I want to make today, if you're following along on your note sheet, is that sometimes I think that we think that we can hitch God's presence to our new cart, right? Sometimes we do. I was thinking about it this way this week. We hitch him to our never-ending to-do lists, right? We hitch him to the list of organizations that we like to be a part of or whatever. We hitch him to our overburdened, stressed out, maxed out, busy schedules, overflowing credit card debt. We hitch him to our new school way of doing life, and then we wonder why we're not experiencing his presence. Then we wonder why he seems so far away. Then we wonder why our life isn't going the way that we want it to go. I mean, I was driving on the 805 the other day, and this Camaro or whatever was going around, and it was just flying. And I said to the crew that we were with at the time, as we're heading somewhere, I was like, oh man, that's a midlife crisis driving down the road, isn't it? Sorry, that's for free. But Jesus, this isn't in my notes, but Jesus, I don't know where it's at, but he said it. If you could fact check me. He said, you don't put new wine into old wineskins, because the new wine and the old wineskins will blow the wineskins up. You put new wine into new wineskins. And the point that he was trying to make, and the point that I'm trying to make, and the point that it comes back to, sometimes we hitch, you know, God's presence to our new technology, our new thing, is this, is Jesus will not be something that you add to your life. He's either taking center stage or he's not taking anything. He's either taking the priority of your life or nothing. That's just biblical. You just read the New Testament. And I mean, like so often, like people are like, well, you know, Jesus, I'll go and follow you after I bury my father and mother, which is like kind of code for, you know, I'm going to wait for my inheritance and then I'll start following you. And Jesus is like, let the dead bury their dead. It sounds horrible to us, but he's like, let the dead bury their dead. Come follow me now or don't follow me. And it's just this idea that I think sometimes we think that we can hitch God's presence to our new technology, our new car, our new way of life, our busy, you know, whatever. And I think that we're just going to find that we don't have his presence if we do that. And that we don't have him in our lives. Once again, I think it's easy to be religious without following Jesus. It just is. See, the reality is he's never asked us to hitch him to our life. He's asked us to be center stage. And then it goes on, verse 6. It says, when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, I love the threshing floor, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark because the oxen stumbled. So they're at the threshing floor, okay? Let me just give a real quick explanation where a threshing floor is. It's like where they would separate the chaff from the wheat, right? They would put the stalks of grain down on like a hard surface, and they would start to separate out the useless from the useful, right? And they would make those separations. So I think it's really ironic that the oxen stumbles at the threshing floor. And as it stumbles, the ark starts to like get off kilter. I don't know if it's falling. I don't know what happens. But as the oxen stumbles, the ark starts to fall off a little bit. And Uzzah's like, uh-oh. And here you go, guys. Here you go. You've been waiting for it. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down and he died beside the ark of God. It's in there. Reaches out, sticks his hand, boom, worship service over. Right? You imagine that? Like, if God's like displeased with whatever we're doing here at Church 180, and like one of y'all or myself just like, boom. And we're like, guys, maybe we'll resume next week. Right? Like, we're gonna go back to the drawing board on how we do church, because you get what I mean. And so that's going on, and the party's over. Worship service is canceled. Bro stops breathing. I mean, put yourself in this scene. And I was thinking about it this week, and I think that really the point that I want to make, if you're following along, is that worshiping God how we want might not be worshiping God. Right? David's throwing the party. He's throwing the service. He's having the, you know, the doing the deal, and it doesn't go well. And here's what I want to say. This is a hard one. This is a really hard one, because I think over the last 100 years, I've explained it a lot during Christmas. We're going to talk about it next series. But over the last 100 years, leading up specifically into the last 30, we have become such a consumeristic culture. That's what we are. We are like companies. I don't need to explain this all, but companies have flip the switch in our brains where we walk around and we are a walking, talking consumer, right? And not that it's about buying things, but we're a walking, talking consumer. And so much of church has become this way as well. It just has. It's not like we can just be a consumer, you know, when we buy things or look at social media or get on Google or do whatever, but we are consumers in all of life. And so much of our worship of God oftentimes is, how did that make me feel, right? That's our consumeristic way of saying it. And so don't get me wrong, at Church 180, we try to do our best. We got the lights up here. We got the screen right there. We got the pipe and drape. And we, you know, try to do a lot of things with production to make this room an environment that you can come into and experience the presence of God in so many ways. But the thing is it's kind of playing into the consumeristic culture that we're talking about. If you're a follower of Jesus, you should be able to worship Jesus in a closet, in an old church, in a young church, in whatever church, right? Like, and we're like, well, how did that song make me feel? How did that, I mean, was the message a little bit funny in that area? Or, you know, like, did you really connect? Or, I mean, I was just looking at the line. You know what I mean? And like, we've become consumers to the point where it's like, well, I didn't connect with that, or I don't do that. You know, and it's just like, what? I mean, I was thinking about this week too, and I'm gonna tell the story, and I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus, but I remember we were in New Zealand. One of my favorite worship songs, and we were going to different churches before we planted a church. Okay, and we're going to all these different churches, and we ended up at this. I don't know the name. I don't need to know the name, but we ended up at this Pentecostal church this one morning, and the carpet smelled really bad, and it's etched in my brain, Consumer Tony. And the band comes up. And there's this like 80-year-old lady with a ribbon. And she was like, woo, woo, like dancing around with this ribbon. And I'm not used to that, whatever. And the band gets up and they play Mighty to Save. And I'm like, okay, this is good. I like Mighty to Save a lot. This is a good song. 28 minutes later, we're still singing Mighty to Save. I told Kelsey as I was leaving, I was like, I never want to hear that song again, ever. Ever. And there's a little truth to that, right? But here's the flip of that. Why can't I worship God for 28 minutes? Right? That's what I started. As I was looking at this text this week, I've not been convicted about that moment ever until this week. And I'm like, what's wrong with me? You know? Like, why can't I worship God for 28 minutes in that way? See, the point of worship is to please God, period. That's it. That's it. I mean, whether it be singing, whether it be the word of God, listening to a message, you know, whatever, whether it be your generosity, whether it be whatever it is that is worship. Worship is not songs. Worship is your life. And worship is pleasing God, period. That's all. It's responding to God for who he is and what he's done and pleasing him as a result of that. Third thing is this, okay, or fourth or whatever you're following along. Following Jesus means we need to follow Jesus, right? I think we see that. Exodus 25, Numbers chapter 4, we see that God had, he hadn't made it super difficult, you know? He hadn't made it like rocket science. He's like, put it on some poles, carry it at shoulder height, make sure it's from the family of Korah, you know? These people that are carrying it, it's not crazy ridiculous, but he'd given them some specific instructions. And they're like, here's my new cart. It makes me think of Ricky. He's got like a cart back there that squeaks, and I'm like, man, sorry. Like, was it a squeaky cart? But the instructions weren't that hard. They just didn't do it. And I think about this passage, and I think about for you and I, like, we sit in churches, and we get in so many debates about XYZ and like all these different things, and it should be done this way, and you shouldn't do that, and you should think this way or vote this way or do this, you know, and whatever. And it's like, none of that's there, but there's a lot that is. Can we just start with that? I mean, there's so many specific instructions to follow it in the New Testament that are designed and given to us for our flourishment and for our ability to thrive at life. And they're not super complex, they're demanding, but they're there. And I think that sometimes, like, we confuse following Jesus with religion sometimes, and religiosity, and routines, and rituals, and coming to church, and doing, you know, and it's like, no, like, we do all this, we have, okay, like, the reason why church is so important, the reason this gathering is so important is because it sets our hearts and minds for the next 6 days on following Jesus with our lives. That's the point. It's not that coming to church makes you good with God or you know, any of that stuff. It's to say, without a body like this, without relationships and without people, you are going to get off track and you are going to be formed by the world, and you're going to follow whatever your heart little desires, you know, ever at any crossroads. And this gathering is meant to be like, no, let's set our eyes on Jesus, and let's look at the things, let's look at the way that he lived his life, and let's follow him and do things his way. That's the thing. So following Jesus means we follow Jesus. And so I got to be brief here, because I wish we had time to just unpack all of chapter 6. We got places to get, and Easter's coming, and we got to wrap this series up. So the worship service is over. Everybody goes home. The ark goes to Obed-Edom's home. We don't know much about Obed-Edom, but the ark goes to his home. David's like, I don't want to be around that thing for a little while. And so the ark goes to this guy named Obed-Edom's home. And let's just say Obed-Edom has a barn. He puts it in the barn, whatever. And for the next 2 years, the ark just sits there, and Obed-Edom starts to flourish. Like, he's becoming wealthy, everything's going up and to the right, like it's all, like everything's working out for Obed-Edom, and everybody in the nation is seeing this and taking witness to this and putting their eyes on this, and finally David's just like, gotta get that ark back to the city. Right? Got to get that ark back. So he does. So he goes back to, he's a good little boy, and he goes back to Exodus chapter 25 and Numbers 4, and they dot every I, cross every T, and go overboard in following Jesus, or following God at that time and his instructions. And they start the worship service up again. They get all the people around, they start the dancing, they get the ark, they carry it on poles, the sons of Korah take it, you know, they hold the whole thing. They go overboard to the point where, get this, I don't know how long they had to transport it. I should have looked it up. I don't know. But they're transporting this ark. Let's say if it was a football field, what they do is still crazy. And it's a lot longer than a football field. Every six steps, they stop and sacrifice an animal. Every six steps, like one, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, kill the bull. Kill the bull. We're going to stop right here. Keep it on your shoulders, boys. No relief. Sons of Korah. It's got to be sons of Korah. You know what I mean? Like they're following, dotting every I, crossing every T. And finally they get this ark to Jerusalem. And it resides there in the city of what becomes the city of David, the city of Jerusalem. And so it's there. Things seem to be going really well. There's this famous exchange, like I wish I had time, where Michal, David's first wife, Saul's daughter, first wife, she, you know, is kind of devious anyway and never really had her heart on the things of God. And she looks down and David, like, is so freaking out worshiping that he, like, strips down to his underwear and he's, like, dancing like crazy. And he says, I'm going to become even more undignified than this. Like, I'm going to be humiliated in my own eyes to please God and to worship God. And that's really cool. But the ark gets to Jerusalem. It's sitting there. And in chapter 7, verse 1, it says this. After the king was settled in his palace and the Lord had given him rest from all of his enemies around him, he said to Nathan the prophet, here I am living in a house of cedar while the ark of God remains in a tent. So Nathan replied to the king, whatever you have in mind, go ahead and do it, for the Lord is here with you. So David wants to demonstrate his love for God by building the first ever church, the temple, okay? This is his love language to God. He like wants to worship God by building God a church, a house, a temple at the time. And so, you know, it made me think about the five love languages, right? Whenever you think about this, like David's trying to love God through, like he wants a house, right? He's trying to love God through his love language. I remember when Kelsey and I first got married and we would mix it up all the time with how loving each other the way that we would prefer to be loved rather than the way that they wanted to be loved and the whole thing, you know what I mean? And so here's David like, I love you, God. I'm building you a house. And Nathan, you know, the prophet's like, oh, whatever you have fit to do. And then finally God speaks to Nathan in a dream and says, I don't want a house. You think I need a house? Like, you know what I mean? Like what are you doing? Like, love me the way that I want to be loved. And I was thinking about this, and I think that we get our wires crossed so many times in the church with loving God, right? Like we do. And so John chapter 14, verse 15, it says this. He says, if you love me, okay, this is what he says. He says, if you love me, then tell me that you love me, right? Oh, it doesn't say that? What about this one? If you love me, why don't you go to church more often? You heathens. If you love me, then at 6:30 a.m. tomorrow, get your butt out of bed and read your Bible. Does it say that? It says, if you love me, keep my commands, right? And loving Jesus, it means that we obey Jesus. Following Jesus means we actually follow him, and loving him means we actually obey him. See, take this back to following Jesus means, following Jesus. Take it back to the way the ark was meant to be carried. Take it back to David wanting to show his love for God through a building project. It's really simple, yet really demanding. These are not going to be on your note sheet. You might want to write them down, whatever. But I think there's five things that get in the way of obeying Jesus on a regular basis. And we're just going to fly through them. But it's this. Number one, traditions, right? I think traditions can sometimes get in the way of actually obeying Jesus. They just can. Like, we can become so much more enamored by the ritual, so much more enamored by the tradition, than actually looking at the Word of God and doing what He wants us to do. Number two, legalism, right? Legalism can get in the way of following Jesus. Legalism is where we basically create fences around maybe what God said. Where, you know, I remember whenever we first got married, Kelsey and I first got married, we chose not to get married in Kelsey's home church because they did not allow dancing, right? And so we're like, well, we're going to dance at our wedding, so we got to change the venue and stuff. And that, I mean, dancing, once again, like, you know, I understand the heart behind it, but that was a fence that, you know, because it was like, well, people who dance are promiscuous, right? And so promiscuity can be thwarted if we just cut dancing off, right, at the thing. I mean, I think about, like, Hawaii, right? My favorite sport of surfing almost was ruined because the Baptist missionaries came through, and they're like, look at you, half-naked people floating on logs and stuff like that. Surfing is evil, right, and stuff. And it's this form of tradition that fences around maybe the actual sin and the actual command that Jesus has. And sometimes we can play the legalistic game in church, right? We can. And we can put roadblocks in the way of actually obeying Jesus. So number two, legalism. Number three, passion, right? Passion. I think passion is a good thing. Zeal is a good thing. Like, having your heart stirred and moved is a good thing, but sometimes it can be something that gets in the way of actually following the commands and being obedient to Jesus. Because we can mistake our passion for life when Jesus just said, I just asked you to do what I asked you to do. Like, I just asked you to obey in this way. Number four, Bible knowledge. Holy cow, right? Like, don't trust me because I know a lot about the Bible. Trust me because of my life, right? and my obedience to Jesus. And I think we can get that wrong too, that if you know a lot about the Bible, you must be super spiritual and obeying Jesus. Like, no, you can know a lot about the Bible and completely disobey Jesus in so many ways. And number five, separation from the world. I don't think many of us struggle with that one, but I think that's a real thing where it's kind of like, okay, like, I'm going to distance myself and only have, like, Christian friends and da-da-da-da. And the reality is this, as this is not in your note sheet, it should have been. I messed up. But obeying Jesus primarily means loving other people. That's what it means. I mean, like, Jesus said it this way. He said, love me with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. All of the other law and prophets hang on these two things, meaning 613 commands that they had in that day hung on our love for God and love for people. And y'all, we don't always do a great job at that. I was listening to a podcast yesterday, and I'm not going to go too much into it because it can get really controversial in a hurry. But basically, it was a sober warning to pastors saying the next 18 to 24 months are going to be turbulent in churches because we've got another election coming up. And the thing that that really just stood out to me from the podcast was just how the thing that you need to be concentrated on as a pastor is cultivating empathy amongst your people. And that's what I'm going to strive to do over the next few months, is to say, you know what, guys, election season's coming up. That's not a free pass to be a jerk. It's a free pass to be Jesus to the world around you and to have empathy for the world around you and to love others as Christ loved us. It just is, in so many ways. Obeying Jesus primarily means loving other people. So the rest of the story, Nathan shares that God doesn't need a house, but he'll allow his offspring to eventually build the temple. But it's not David's job because he has too much blood on his hands. So I have to read this part. 2 Samuel 7, it's the last verse, 11, the back half of verse 11. It says this, it says this, the Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He's the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he'll be my son. And when he does wrong, I'll punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands. But my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me, and your throne will be established forever. This is known as, it's a real famous part of scripture, this is known by Bible scholars as the Davidic covenant, okay? And so this is where David would have his permanent place in history etched down forever, because David was promised in this. He didn't understand the fruition of that promise. We look back on it now and we get it, but David was promised that the Messiah would come through his bloodline. And so despite the wickedness that he does, despite the craziness of the people that come after him and the generation of millennia after him, Jesus still comes through him as the forever king who will reign forever through his bloodline. And that's what he's saying. He's like, I don't need a house, but I'll let your son build me a house, and I will establish your kingdom through this covenant forever through my son, through Jesus in that. And the last thing I want to say is this, and to kind of close is this. Band, you guys can go ahead and start making your way up here. Because I think we see this all throughout chapter 6 and 7, and I think this is where it kind of comes together. It's the fear of God that ushers in the joy in the promises of God. It's the fear of God that ushers in the joy and promises of God. Y'all, we're living in a day where I feel like our culture is maybe starting to come back, but we don't have the stomach for the whole picture of God in our 21st century. We stand up here and we say things that are true, and we say things all the time like God is love. He is love. Like, he loves you more than you love yourself. He's love. But there's an element to God where, like we talked about in this passage, that he is all-consuming and terrifying. Right? It's like they said about Aslan, like, not, of course he's not safe. People disobey him and reach out and touch an ark and they pass over dead. But he's good. He's good. I was thinking about this week. There's so many different metaphors that I've used over the years as a pastor trying to talk about the fear of God. Like, later on this year, we're going to be going into David's son, his book, Ecclesiastes, my favorite book in the Bible. We're going to be doing that later on this year. And he talks about the fear of God so much in that book. And I was thinking about this passage in a couple ways as we kind of conclude. The first way is this, is that, man, like, when it comes to my father daughter-son relationship, I don't want my kids to just think I'm a pushover, right? I want them to know that they can have a good old healthy dose of respect for me and also know that I love the crap out of them. And I'm there for them, and I do anything for them. And I think you kind of get it. There's like a picture there with God where, like, God is like, don't mess with me, but I'm good and I love you. Don't misstep here. Don't look at me like some grandpa up in the sky or Santa Claus or some genie or whatever kind of crap our culture throws out. Don't look at me like that. Look, like understand that I mean business, but I love you more than you could love. You know what I mean? And it's like this like, going back to my kids, without that healthy dose of respect, it's hard to experience the joy that life has. Because we sit in here and all the time we talk about the grace and we talk about the mercy, we talk about the forgiveness. We're going into communion. We're going to talk about that right now. But forgiveness doesn't mean anything if you're not forgiven from something that's terrifying. It just doesn't matter. Philosophically, it breaks down, right? And so it's that fear of God that ushers in the joy, and as we see for David, the promises of God. And see, we are taking communion during this last song. And communion is just that reminder that we've got a scary God who loves us a ton. That we've got a God who is none other. But he wants to forgive you. He wants to love you. And he wants to set you on a course towards flourishment in your life. And he did that through his Jesus's body being broken and his blood being poured out on the cross. And so during any time during this next song, you can get up and take the emblems that are in the back. The little cracker there, a little juice, represents the body and the blood of Jesus that was broken for our hope and forgiveness and our ability to be saved from his wrath. So Jesus, thank you, thank you, thank you. May our lives be marked by actually following you. Not talking about it, not going through the rituals, not going through the routines, not playing church, but following you, Jesus. It's in your name we pray.